Good morning. Hello and welcome to Between the Lines, Near FM's weekly current affairs discussion programme. Dermot Brangan is my name, and our studio guests this week are a group of professionals. Heidi, Bronwyn, Keith and Ger. Folks, you're all very welcome.
Thank you.
And we've a busy schedule for today. We'll be focusing on the children's referendum and indeed public sector increments. But we're going to kick off with Sean Quinn. And just to remind you, 867 1190 is the phone number if you'd like to call us. Or you can text us on 087 69 44 500. As I say, we'd love you to get involved in what we're discussing here today. So keep your calls and your texts coming. And we'll remind you that phone number and text number throughout the programme. But we look forward to your participation in the programme. Folks, I think, as I said, Heidi, Bronwyn, Keith and Ger, all presenters of this programme, so I think we'll have a very good programme and a good discussion, but we're going to kick off with Sean Quinn, jailed for contempt. I'd love a discussion on that, and I'd love the views of you four professionals. What you
Are
think
you sure?
of him. Yeah, what you think of him being, you know, I'm not saying I'm on the agreement side of it, but I'm going to throw it open to the panel now. Who'd like to kick off on that? Ger?
Yeah, I think the judge was right. It was a simple case. He was found guilty of contempt, not only himself, but his son and his other son who is in Fermanagh, hiding from justice.
His nephew,
Peter's son. I know they have a lot of support, and the support up around the border area is tribal, and it's city against rural. What the judge has said was that at the contempt level, it was at very much at the higher level of contempt of court. What the Quinns did was they put over 500 million out of the way of what was Anglo-Irish Bank, which we now own. And there are also questions now, as in the papers this morning, as to whether the fraud squad should actually be investigating the Quinns. This was a case of a man who did set up a lot of businesses and was a very bright man and, by all accounts, a very nice man. But he was a ruthless businessman. And we're supposed to believe that this ruthless businessman, very successful businessman initially, was able to be fooled by a couple of three or four suits from Anglo-Irish Bank into parting with his money. What he did was he took a gamble. He lost. We're paying for it. And he won't even tell us where the money went to. And there are some suspicions out there, and I know it's been investigated as to whether there's more money, whether there's more money that has been put offside and offshore. Mm-hmm. And I think to be honest with you, I think the sentence is probably appropriate. 9 weeks doesn't seem to me to be that long a time, but for contempt, at least the judge has actually put a time on it. I remember the Rossport people were 100 days because there was no end date put on their contempt of court at the time.
Okay, before we go deeper into this discussion, and I think it is a very good topical and very emotive topic.
I'm trying to keep emotion out of it. Just look at the legal situation.
No, but just before we go further on it with the rest of the panel, I'd like to just hop the ball on one little issue, and that is that he sent his firm of accountants in to check the books in Anglo. And the read he got from them was that it'd be a good investment to go in with his bigger money. He had a little investment at that stage, but that the investment would be a good investment to put in bigger money. Now, what my sympathy towards Sean Quinn is that those books were a false read because millions had been transferred from Irish Life to give the books a good read at the end of the year. Now, to me, this is damn deceit. This is outright, and the Quinn family felt he could feel quite justified that the read he got from the books were wrong because so many millions had been taken out of Irish Life and put across. Now, that being so, when the crisis did break, they probably should have said, well, there's two sides to this story. Let us work with them. And I think we, the taxpayer, would not be caught for half the money we're being caught if the balance had been shown, you know, and that they worked with them,
Dermot,
rather than turn them against.
Sorry, Dermot, you're wrong on a number of accounts here.
Go ahead.
Right. One is that you were talking about the Anglo-Irish Bank is an absolute basket case, and I would like to see people go to jail for what happened there. But what Quinn did, he did a number of things as well. One of the other things which Quinn and his people had done was that they were using money, they were moving money around from company to company. And that I would see look into as well. This idea that he's an innocent abroad. This was a man who knew exactly what he was doing. This was a man.
Sorry,
this,
no, I no, didn't this was say a man he's an innocent. I'm just asking for a
yeah,
balance.
But this,
so can we throw
not,
it open to the
well,
panel?
Yeah, other people can come in.
Well,
with it.
You see, yeah. You've the two things here. You've the question about his business practice, which mm-hmm. is one thing. That's not what he's gone to jail for, really. It's mm-hmm. just contempt of court. The court asked him to do something. He didn't,
and he
do,
didn't
it.
Do it. Yeah.
And that's a straightforward thing. I mean, how he fell foul, if you like, of the Celtic Tiger and the investments he made and on information that wasn't correct or that was fixed. That's not really what this court case is about. That's whether you have sympathy for him and his
the point I was making, and you can discuss it and it'll be right or wrong, and I'm not saying it's right, I'm just asking you to keep it in mind when you have the discussion. My point is that he lost the goodwill of the state, shall we say, and when he lost their goodwill, he basically got his back up against what he felt were all against him, if you know what I mean.
So he threw 500 million beyond reach then in a huff.
No, that's been too narrow. That's been too narrow. Go ahead.
And you asked the question initially about his going to prison, really, for the 90 days. And that's nothing to do with whether you feel sympathy for him or not. It's a black and white case. He purged the court.
Oh, he did.
Oh, no, he didn't. He was in contempt of the court. Mm-hmm. So, yes, if somebody is in contempt of court, they must go to prison. That's if you don't do that, well, then people are going to feel that they don't have to do what the court tells them at all, ever.
Yeah.
So you have to stick by the rule. Now, I think one of the things which was pointed out to me was that we have yet to hear his side of the case.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps the court enforcing their ruling before they had heard his side of the case was something that could have been done differently.
Too sharp.
Things could have run in a different order, maybe. And perhaps if that had happened, he would not have been in contempt of court. Maybe there would have been a different way that he could have operated. So, I mean, there's lots of different ways of running a court case, I think.
I know.
And you can trip somebody up, and maybe this has been set up so that he cannot help but be in contempt of court and be sent to prison. But I do think, though, that the general public politically want people to go to prison, and that perhaps he is being used as a bit of a scapegoat in that respect.
That's the point. Keith or Bronwyn, would you come in on that, please?
Yeah, I suppose just to take it away a bit from the personal, which is very difficult to do in the Sean Quinn case, because he's a very big personality. And I think mm-hmm. that in part is how he's been such a successful businessman before the big crash came and he got involved in that through his investment strategy. I think there's a number of things here. Number one, there's the huge PR campaign that the Quinn family themselves have been running, which has made this intensely personal. And I think in a way, he's a victim of his own publicity campaign and mm-hmm. has nearly been mm-hmm. caught in a sort of a trajectory of how he has to be the big man the small man fighting against the big giants. So maybe that's the problem as well.
I think possibly...
Let's step back a bit away from Quinn and say possibly they should go more quietly now and actually deal with this legal case in a very, very steady, sensible and professional way and get away from the media, which will be difficult because the obvious interest the media will have in a character like him and the story. I mean, the media wait outside for the visits for the son. And you know what I mean?
I know. Son drops bag into dad.
Yeah, that's
it's been turned into a tabloid story. Yeah. So there's lots of things going on here. But number one, I think also this galvanising of public opinion in Cavan, this huge emotion that's been steeped up, I don't think is good for... I don't think it's good for Ireland, full stop, because I think we need...
Well, as Ger says, it's a tribal thing there.
It's a local, you know. She's a local chieftain in Fermanagh and, and around the border.
And people, and in times of great stress, you always, people always retreat back to what they know, which is usually their family and their community. And people they've known well. So I think there's an aspect of that security behaviour going on there. But I don't think, again, as we're back to the Quinn family, it was quite a deliberate campaign to stoke up all this passion locally, to get to, you know, to try and run, feeding into their PR campaign. But I don't think it's actually good for Ireland generally to have these highly individualised and personalised stories. I think, and now it's easier said than done, we need to look back and ask, how do we get to the situation we are now? Now, there's global influences. There's no denying about that. I'm talking about the banking crisis and the investment crisis. But here at home as well, we made mad decisions. Personally, individually, in who we voted for and the stories we believed and who we wanted to represent us at government level. And also ourselves getting caught up in this massive hype that there's no limit. The world has no limits, which is unrealistic. So I think I would prefer to see proper analysis of what sort of a world we want to live in, rather than indulging in lots of stories about very, very interesting individuals. But it's difficult. It's difficult. Yeah. And it's nearly easier to follow the stories of Sean Quinn and his family than to actually sit back and say, how are we going to fix things so that we don't get into this boom and bust situation?
Exactly.
Because his story is nearly a parable of the whole Celtic tiger.
It is, as you say, it's lower profile, it should be dealt with by both sides.
On a personal level, I would, if I was advising him, say, look, stop it, just because they are in trouble now. You know, from what I can read in the papers, and Heidi's right, the man was jailed because he...
Or contempt, yeah.
Of course, that's what's happened today.
Cut and dried,
and he'll be there for
that's
the next
not part of it.
That's
but
not
it's inter-
part of
yeah,
it,
yeah, no, it's to me, it's interfering with the big picture, and there's goodwill wanted on both sides in the bigger picture, and that's where we should be at. Keith, please.
I suppose Ger and yourself, Dermot, have enunciated the kind of diametrically opposing views in this discussion, but in a sense, you're both right. I mean, Ger is right in saying that fundamentally, Sean Quinn Sr. has been jailed just for contempt of court because he put those assets beyond the court's reach. And so in that sense, yes, the court was right to send him to prison, because without it, we have anarchy, in effect. We have nobody obeying the law, and you know the law
everyone
has to be...
do what they want to do.
Exactly. And the law has to be seen to have some teeth. And so Ger's right in that way. But you're also right in that there is a bigger picture here. And I think that we're going to see that unfold as the cases of the three former Anglo executives come to court now. We're going to see, was it illegal that money was moved to Irish Nationwide and back again to hoodwink auditors? And, you know, was the so-called the Golden Ten, these investors that were brought in, given non-recourse loans to prop up the bank, was that legal? And so we're going to see all of that come out in the wash. And it may well come down to it that Sean Quinn and his family were actually victims of a fraud in that way. And so, ironically, we could actually see some or all of this money returned to them in the long run. That may happen. But in the short term, what he did was wrong. He was in breach of the court order and he has to pay the penalty for it. But I think he was a bit naive. And in as much as they have, as Bronwyn said, instituted an enormous PR campaign to try and build up some kind of a groundswell of sympathy for them, they're extraordinarily naive, having seen Sean Quinn Jr. jailed, that they thought that 3 months later they'll come back to court and Sean Quinn Sr. will, because of a PR campaign, not be jailed. I mean, the judge is going to have absolutely no interest in a PR campaign. And, you know, the one thing that a judge is always going to be concerned about is the probity and the respect for the court. I mean, if you're challenging the court itself, it's the very last thing you should do. You know, I mean, they'll let you off with, you know, as we saw recently, a chap sexually assaulted a woman and was let off with, you know, a slap on the wrist. But if you're in any way disrespectful to the court, you're going to prison. And that's just it. If you shout out in court, you can go to prison for a day. So they're extraordinarily naive to think that he wasn't going to be jailed. But you can't help but think of, you know, the parables, as Bronwyn was saying, you know, Icarus. I mean, this is a man who flew too close to the sun, you know, and really I think he's just coming a cropper as a result.
Well, okay, Jerry, I'll let you in just now.
Okay.
But the point made there was, that you've made even clearer, is the fact that the company had a crisis. Now, if you put a hold on it where you appointed a state auditor to run the company, but you kept the goodwill of the Quinn family and the other side and let them all make their arguments, both, the, as you said, the moving of the money and all this sort of thing, at least you would have a better control on it and the whole empire would have been under the control of whoever was appointed. And that would have kept it right.
But they can't
instead
do that.
Instead of that, no, but instead
but they can't do that now until the criminal charges go through the courts.
Yeah. I know, but the point is, if it was dealt with right at the start, I reckon we, as taxpayers, would not be caught for half of what we're going to
but,
be caught
But
for.
we're missing the wood for the trees Fair. Here. Sorry, we're just missing the wood for the trees here. Because, you know, as Ger said earlier, you know, we're on the hook for this money. And while the 500 million was ostensibly put out of the reach of the IBRC, which is the former Anglo, and Ger was saying, well, really, that's us because we own them. It's the taxpayer that's on the hook for it. You know, we are missing the wood for the trees. Why are we on the hook for it? We're on the hook for it, not because of what Sean Quinn did, not because of what Shawnee Fitzpatrick or any of these guys did. We're on the hook for it because we decided as a government to take the losses of private banks. Now, that was the insane move. So in a way, you can say, oh, well, it's Sean Fitzpatrick's fault that we have this loan, this debt, or it's Sean Fitzpatrick's fault that we have this debt. It's not. In actual fact, it's probably Fianna Fáil and the Greens' fault that we have this debt because they're the ones who made the decision to take on this debt.
Gerald, let you in a minute. I think Keith is saying what I was trying to say as well, is that I would rather see us having a really good look and saying, how do we as a nation get to where we are now, where we have nationalised huge private debt? You know, people ran up huge debts and we, each one of us sitting around this table, all the listeners, are paying that debt back.
Yeah.
So, but that's, we all know that story. I'd prefer for us to be discussing where we want to go and what sort of a world we want to live in. I think there's too little of that going on. There's crisis management sort of dialogue where it's all panic talk all the time rather than sitting back. There's certain things we have to do now. There's certain obligations we've signed up to. I think part of the dialogue should we be standing over promises we made, like to the ECB and the EU? I think there's a case for us saying, you know, no, we were made certain decisions under duress. But I'm going off on a tangent.
Yeah.
But as you know, Sean Quinn is the embodiment of everything that went mad, I think.
Okay, back to you for
one or two points. I think there's a general feeling that the law has to be upheld. That's fine. But also we have, and there's also cases coming up with the three former directors. But there's also a case between the what was Anglo and also with the Quinns, and that's going to be next year before that gets through the courts. But we should remember as well that when the receiver was sent into the Quinn group, the receiver's cars and stuff was attacked. So from the very word go, when the receivers went in, there was this feeling of hurt and a rear guard action fought by the Quinns. And what came out in this contempt case was that the person who orchestrated and who was the main mover in moving the funds beyond reach of Anglo and by extension ourselves was Sean Quinn himself. So it really is, it's hard to feel, see, on a human level you feel sorry for somebody, but if the law isn't upheld in this case, which was an absolute blatant contempt, then, you know, where are we?
It has to be dealt with.
The judge said it herself. He's the author of his own downfall, and he was.
Folks, we're going to leave it at that and move on, but just comment from Vincent Quinn. Sean Quinn wouldn't have been in contempt of court if he had not been forced into it by Anglo. The government should have never bailed them out. Now, regardless of, this is from Aoife Corcoran, regardless of what happened, he was in contempt of court. To defend him is ludicrous. I think it's a disgrace to feel sympathy for him. So, you know, these are the kind of comments you get. That's to do with the later issue. And there's a comment here on the screen. Morning all at BTL. About Sean Quinn. It's very sad that he worked so hard for his money. Just look at the wads of money that Fingleton and Fitzpatrick got for robbing us, and they didn't even wear a mask. That's from Betty in Malahide. Thanks, Betty.
Allegedly, Betty.
Allegedly, yeah.
Hasn't gone through the courts yet.
I know, yeah. T. to your panel. Do parents have the right to know before their children's referendum? Well, we're going to deal with that now in a few minutes. But just to say that we're going to move on from Sean Quinn. That's a story that'll run and run, and I think we'll all be presenting a programme here as the time goes on, dealing with the same subject. I think we'll all get a shot at that again, because that's how long I feel it's going to run. But anyway, moving on, and just to remind you, Heidi, Branwen, Keith and Ger are around the table with me here, and we're going to discuss now the children's referendum. And this is a very deep subject, and I'm wondering what percentage of people fully understand the depth of this thing we're going to vote on. Who'd like to come in and offer an opinion?
If you like, I...
Chair or Keith, did you want to come in?
No,
and
Heidi wants to go first.
Heidi,
yes.
Heidi, okay. You have your hand up first. Go
yes,
ahead.
Yes, sir. Please, sir. no, I was reading this morning, the Alive magazine came through, the Catholic newspaper. And actually, it's very good, and I would recommend anyone who is confused or doesn't really, you know, wants to have a little read. It's written quite easily.
I think
there wasn't enough
discussion on this.
Yeah, well, what I like about this, they have devoted a full page to the referendum and the details, and they actually they state the different parts of the changes, the provisions that will be put into the Constitution if we pass it. And they pick up on some of the wording that is a little bit ambiguous. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably really good about it. Now, on the downside of from their perspective, they talk about the rights of parents to protect their children an awful lot, and there's huge assumptions running right the way through it that all parents are the utopian parents, if you know what I mean, that they're all they talk about caring and self-sacrifice of the parents and all that kind of thing, and that is wonderful, and I'm sure the majority of parents are like that. Yeah. But they're not all like that. And what I get really from the changes is that the child is about to be declared a citizen, a full citizen. Once they're declared a citizen, they have all the rights of every other European or Irish citizen. And that's the bottom line of it, really. They have the rights to defend themselves. They have the rights to express themselves. before, they weren't allowed to express themselves in a court of law. And it's giving the opportunity for children to actually speak against their parents, which I believe is not allowed between spouses at the moment. You're not compelled to to speak against your spouse in order to keep the harmony going, which I'm not even too sure about that either. But on balance of reading this, I could see how people could say, well, those certain sentences are quite weak. But I'd say those things will be thrashed out in the courts after the Constitution is changed, which is what usually happens. There's a change in the Constitution. There's vagueness in it. And these vague bits are thrashed out when cases actually come before the courts and new legislation is
well, they were discussing fine-tuned. They were discussing it in a radio programme the other night. It was a television programme, I'm not sure which. And they were just making the point that there's a couple of issues in it that are ambiguous in the sense that they're open to be interpreted in many
Absolutely.
Different ways.
That's it, yeah.
And
yeah.
I don't think that's fair to the public.
Well,
because how are they to know what to think or what conclusions to come to before they vote?
I think, the problem with that is that if you were to pin it down now in the constitutional change, for starters, the change would be a size of a book, because you're nitpicking every single word to try and define each word and what the meaning of those particular words are. This is not unusual for constitutional change. They're always... they're never absolutely watertight, because you don't really know how it's going to play out until the cases come before the courts.
Yeah.
Because you don't actually... you can't really imagine all of the different situations and scenarios that you're going to find when it actually comes down to actual cases. So I think that the article here is right, and you're right there, Dermot, that there is a vagueness about the wording in some, and it contradicts some of the existing constitution. But it's necessarily that way.
Yeah.
I don't think I would change that at this stage. I think that fine-tuning where you define exactly what is meant by prescriptive rights and stuff like that, it'll be done in the courts, which is the way it is or has always been done. And I do think that is still the best way to do it, because if we try to guess now at what all the cases are going to cover, There's no way we can do that. It's not humanly possible.
Yeah, and we might close off doors.
Tie it up too tight so that you end up actually damaging people in the future. Okay. But just to finish there, Dermot, some of the arguments there about children expressing their needs and their rights, and they're saying, well, what do teenagers know about what's good for them? And it just reminds me a little bit about arguments when women were, when they're considering giving women the vote. Women don't know anything about politics. What's the point of giving them the vote? Mm-hmm. Women can't vote. The men will tell them how to vote. The men vote, you know, men make decisions for them, and that women and children were property. And at the moment, unfortunately, I still think that children are seen as property. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's in their interest. I don't think that's working out for them too well. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I've tossed this back and forward, and even with the vagaries of the wording and stuff, I think I'm going to be voting in favour of it. I think it's a step forward. I think we need to trust that the children are citizens.
It's too serious. Yeah. Okay. Now, who else? Who'd like to come in on that?
To be perfectly honest, I suppose I should start this with a confession. I haven't really looked too much into this, and that might shock some people, but it hasn't really been on my radar, and I think a lot of people feel similar, and I wonder about the turnout for this referendum. I think it might be quite low, and whenever you get a low turnout for a referendum, it means the people who turn out are the people who feel passionately about it one way or the other. So I don't think this is as sure a thing as people out there imagine. I think that if the No campaign get out a small but passionate group, they could overturn this if the overall turnout is quite low. Just listening to Heidi there, we come down to the eternal battle of the individual against the state. And yeah. I mean, I'm somebody who has great sympathy for what happened, obviously, to children in this state, at the hands of this state for the last 50 or 60 years. And the notion of giving the state more authority over those children, it irks me a little bit. I mean, this was painted as almost as a referendum to try to undo the past and to try and make sure that the past couldn't happen again. We always think of the church and its crimes against children, and rightfully so when we're talking about this. But don't forget, the state was equally complicit in this. We have Magdalene.
The state offloaded its responsibility,
but it's not even that.
To the religious
But it's not even that, Dermot. We're talking about state institutions, Magdalene laundries, industrial schools. I mean, you know, these were state institutions where these children were abused.
They were, but they were being run by nuns and...
Not all of them.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, if people were to go to the polls thinking, well, if I vote yes to this, it means that these things can't happen again. You know, you're not really thinking clearly, because what you're doing is you're offering the state more power in this situation. Now, we like to think we've learned lessons as a society and that we wouldn't make those same mistakes again. We're human beings. We tend to make similar mistakes over and over. So I would be somewhat worried about that. But in the round, I think that it's a fairly balanced proposal. It offers the state more power, but in a very proportionate way, I think. And as Heidi was saying, you can't really have it too restrictive in the draft, because there could be any number of possibilities that could occur, and the church is a Freudian slip. The courts are the place to actually fight these individual cases out on these bases. So I know we have to be balanced in this, and we have to be very careful where we are with this place. I think I'll probably be voting yes on this.
Interesting. Chair?
Gentlemen?
I'll go, let Ger come in at the end. I know he's got a lot. He's been writing furiously there, so he's got a lot of things to say. I'm going to vote yes. Now, I've been thinking about this for a long time as well. I think it's a very important vote for us. I've been out canvassing for a yes vote on this, and there's overall support for the yes vote. But people are very relaxed about it, I agree. People feel that this is a good thing. It should be voted through. And there is a danger that because people feel it's not controversial, it's something that should happen, that there won't be a big anxiety to get out and make sure that they vote. So therefore, I wouldn't be too confident or relaxed that it's automatically going to be passed. Because like Keith said, the people who are passionately against it are going to be more motivated to come out than the relaxed attitude that I've picked up during the canvass. I'm voting yes because what this does, in my opinion, is not to give the state more power over our lives, but it gives children individual rights in court when an issue relating to their lives has been discussed and decided. And I see, contrary to what Keith has said, appalling things have been done to children in this state since the foundation of the state, since we gained our independence. But I see that as the appalling things happened because children had no right under the constitution in the state. Anything could happen to them. They had no status. Voting yes for this will protect a child who comes before the court because his or her parents have abused them or neglected them terribly. That child and his brothers and sisters will be considered as individuals with rights in front of the court under those circumstances. To me, that is absolutely necessary. A lot of the appalling abuse cases that we've witnessed, when they did reach court, the child's interests could not be taken into account. The parents' viewpoints had stronger and more status under the constitution. So you had situations where very abusive parents were actually allowed to continue have their children at home.
Children were sent back to them. Well, they shouldn't have been. Yes. Now, we've had a lot of adults on television and radio in recent weeks pointing out that they were sent back to their parents when it was an absolute horror to them. They didn't want to go back, but that's what the state
dictated. Because they'd no rights. Yeah. Now, there's a lot of fear out there that this, as Keith says, will give huge power to the states and we'll have social workers visiting all our houses, you know, on the basis of complaints by neighbours that parents are not looking after their children correctly or that the house is not as clean as it should be. And I think that's an understandable fear because a lot of people still have memories of what used to be called the poverty man who had huge power up to the 60s in Ireland. And again, children were taken off poorer families.
Well, does anyone know, will this new bill do away with the right where a parish priest and a Garda could go down to a house and take children out of a home in that way?
Hasn't been done for a generation, can't
hasn't
be done.
But
wait now, it was done. There was a 2-hour documentary
done. Hasn't done for a generation. Let's bring ourselves up to it.
Hold on. The point I'm making is, if it was done, is the law still there that they can do it? That's my point. This, because I think that was a wrong law.
Absolutely.
Well,
two-hour programme that was on telly.
I think, Dermot, that you're actually agreeing with me, then we need a yes vote.
We do need it, but I'm asking about a specific law. It was a family of six over in Fatima Mansions. It was featured on a 2-hour documentary on telly, but long before that ever happened, I knew that family from the time they were small children and grown up at my own age, as it were. And that family was really cut to bits and very badly hurt because mum was gone, dad wasn't considered suitable.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Now, and
especially if you had daughters or sons.
The guy was absolutely a very good father. And proved that over the following 20-odd years that I knew the family and I was up in their home quite
Dermot,
a lot.
There's been huge human rights abuse and that's what happened in the Magdalen Laundries.
But is this law being done away with? That's my point.
Hold on. What we're actually voting on when we go to the polls next Saturday is actually to amend the Constitution to give children individual rights in the Constitution, which they don't have now. And I think it's very important that people keep focused on that.
So even if you take your situation there where the child was pulled out of the house, in the situation you've described there, the child had no...
Five of six of them were taken out.
Five children were taken out. Hmm. The children had no rights. So they couldn't they couldn't take any... They had no say. Their opinions were completely irrelevant.
Okay.
At least if this law is passed, the children have rights. So they have a right to say, we're not going anywhere, we're staying here. Or, no, we're not staying here, we're leaving. One of the things, the other controversial things, a specific point there is that it will become possible for children to be adopted against the wishes of the parents, which is not currently possible. So grandparents can forcibly adopt their grandchildren, if you like, or other family members can, if they feel that there's a need, they can actually adopt the children.
And that would be preferable so that the child wasn't being removed from its full family background, as it were, even if they were removed from the parents, but that they had the grandparents and the other family still accessible. I think that'd be a good thing.
You could see situations where that would be beneficial, but the main point is that in all of these situations, the child has a right.
Yeah.
The child can be heard
in
the court.
Will actually have a voice and a right in court, which
absolutely
they do not have now.
Chair,
yeah,
give you last word on this.
Okay, firstly, the amendment is, I think, very important. The point that Keith made earlier on about, you know, that, you know, it not being engaged. The reason for that is really that the media hasn't showed any interest in it because most of the groups in society are actually supporting the referendum, and the people who are against it have been very small in numbers and haven't really mounted an open campaign. But I'm sure there's lots of talk going on in the background, and there are some groups there who will mobilise their core support. So it's cases like this and programmes like this which actually raise the awareness. Just a couple of points: children were seen as property. You know, and it is very, very important that children are recognised in their own right. That's what's part of this referendum. And it also makes children equal in the eyes of the law. Very, very important. And it gives children a say in their future. Like all things that are put into our constitution, this is an aspirational document, and it will be tackled, and it will be tackled in the court. And also, what this does as well, it puts more responsibility on the state to do right by children. This referendum is a first step. This isn't, we've dealt with children. We all know what happened both in state care and with the clergy in the last 10, 20, 30, 40 years, and it's been an appalling stain, right? Mm-hmm. This is a chance to start the process of looking after children in a more caring, compassionate way, but giving them full access. It is very important that people go out and vote, whatever way they vote. Also, they should remember that the polls actually open at 9 o'clock, not 7. So it's 9 o'clock on Saturday morning until 10 o'clock on Saturday night. So a lot of those people who had a lot of disquiet over the way children were treated in the last 20 or 30 years, this is a chance for you to go out and actually vote. This is a children's referendum. So it's on all those people who are very, very justly disgusted by how we've dealt with children in the last generation or two to go out and do something about it.
I think your point is well made, Ger, and first step would be the title of your comment there, that it is the first step in a long process.
Absolutely.
That will be improved as time goes on.
It has to improve.
Folks, we'll have to leave it there. We're going to a break shortly. But just from Peter Preston, before people vote on the referendum, they should know about my protest against child abuse, which General Politics has acknowledged. Can a government have children's rights at heart if the referendum is tarnished? Now, I don't know what they mean by tarnished, but they probably feel it's not complete or that we're picking holes in the proposed referendum. But, I mean, we're only teasing it out here, and I'd say that to all our listeners.
Yeah, and I'm just
wondering.
We're
teasing it out, and even what Ger has rightly said, and I would highlight his comments as first step. It's the first step in a process that hopefully will be improved as time goes on. Yeah. Richie Blake, this is yet another referendum that takes more power from this from the state and hands it over to the EU. Now, I don't know how... I don't know what...
I'd love to know the thought process there.
Yeah, the thought process there doesn't really come to mind. Now, I'm worried that the state... This is from Mike O'Connor. I'm worried that the state would act too quickly in taking children out of families and putting them up for adoption. So, that's just another comment there. Rose Hanlon Malahide... This is the first step of improvement. I don't understand the no point of view. Let us have the first step. So funny enough, talking about your first step. It's interesting, yeah.
I'm sorry, Dermot, I know you want to move on, but just to remind everybody, the vote is next Saturday.
It's a Saturday coming.
And Ger says 9 o'clock start, not 7.
And everyone just to remember and get out to vote.
Okay, we're going to a short break. We'll be back with you in less than 2 minutes. Thank you. Yes, we're back again. And just to remind you, Dermot Brangan here, and our studio guests are my fellow colleagues in the presenting of Between the Lines. That's Heidi, Bronwyn, Keith and Ger. Folks, you're all very welcome back. And I'm just going to mention the phone number again, 867 1190. And also, of course, text your message to 087 69 44 500. Now, I'm just going to reread a note that I read, and I don't think I read it very clearly. This is from Peter Preston. Before people vote on the referendum, they should know about my protest against child abuse, which several politicians have acknowledged. Can a government have children's rights at heart if their reputation is tarnished? And the government's reputation, I'm sure it, we'd all agree, is tarnished. And I think in your discussion around the table, three of the four of you mentioned the fact that you'd be fearful of giving the government more power. But I think we can do is make sure that things that are questionable are brought before the courts and the best outcome has the child's interest at heart at all times.
While listening to the child as well.
Yeah, well, I think children...
It's important just to distinguish, though, between the government and the state, Dermot, because the government, we may all have political views about the government, but the state is a separate entity and the state will go on far beyond this government.
And this is the constitution, which is the supreme sort of document.
Supreme body, yeah.
And also just to remember that virtually every single political party in the state is supporting a yes vote. Mm-hmm. In the Dáil and outside the Dáil. As far as I know, it's a very small minority, is not.
Actually, can I just make one point on that, Dermot?
We will, because we have to move on.
I just want to make one very quick point. Mm-hmm. While all the parties are supporting the referendum, some have put up posters, there's very few parties who have actually gone up and gone to the doorstep to talk to people about it. And I'm very... I see that a lot of the ULA, the People Before Profit, a lot of those groups...
Yeah.
Actually, activity on this, which is a big social issue for people in the country, have been noticeable by their absence. So I think that point needs to be made as well.
No, it's a very, very well made. And when Heidi was reading her report there, I think I made the point that there hasn't been near enough discussion on this on our national airwaves.
Why the parties as well? They haven't been going around knocking on doors, with the exception of Labour and maybe one or two others.
Just as Bramman rightly said, they're all in agreement to do it, but there's none of them educating the public on it.
Well, except the Labour Party. I was out canvassing, as I said. Yeah, no, it's true.
Fair comment.
And knocking on the doors about
okay,
this.
Well, we're going to move on. 867 1190 if you want to call us, or 087 69 44 500 if you want to text us. We'd be delighted to get your comments on the programme. Nice to know you're listening to us, and we're getting a lot of feedback, and thank you for that. Folks, we're going to move on, and to Heidi, Bronwyn, Keith and Ger, our last topic for discussion, public sector increments. Very hot subject. Keith, can I touch on you for that? To start with,
no, you have rights.
You opened the can of worms.
First of all,
you have rights. Yeah.
First of all, I object to your language. But anyway, okay. I wrote an article on journal.ie during the week, and I don't know if anybody's read it. But in essence, we're approaching the budget time, and this is when all of the kites are flown, and this is when we start to make the choices as to how we're going to fund the state, and also what we want to fund as a state. And so, really, what my article was trying to do was point out that the answer is not always to press the more tax button, okay? Mm-hmm. And what we've heard in recent times is a few Labour TDs, Tommy Bruin, Patrick Nulty in particular, and then a few more have come out since, Joanna Tuffy, have been suggesting that we increase income tax, or we increase USC, which is effectively tax on income. And this is obviously the way to go. We need more tax, and this will continue to feed the programmes that the state wants to engage in. Now... But what I'm, and this was all on the background is, we're cutting our spending. Of course we're cutting our spending, but we have to increase our tax as well. Now, the first thing to say is, we as a state are not cutting our current expenditure. I'll just say that again. Mm-hmm. We as a state are not cutting the spending that we, our day-to-day spending, okay? From 2007 to 2012, believe it or not, we as a state are spending more, okay? Mm-hmm. All that's happening is we are redirecting the spending. So instead of the spending going to health or education, our spending is now going to social welfare because more people are on the dole, and our spending is going to paying off interest on bonds and bank bailouts and other things. Okay, so we as a state are not decreasing our spending. That's the most important thing to get across. So now we have what are we going to do? Are we going to actually cut spending, or are we going to just keep pressing the more tax button? All right. Now, I would suggest that when you have a marginal rate of tax of 52% on anybody earning over €32,000, we are at the limit of what we can tax people. We have now reached the point where once you've earned €32,000, the state is getting more from your day's work than you are. And I think that's fundamentally wrong, and I think that is unfair. If you are to say, well, what about people on €100,000? Surely they're rich. Well, we're talking about two guards or nurses on €50,000 each. That's a household on €100,000. I wouldn't consider them to be the rich. And I don't think you can keep going back to that well and keep pressing the more tax button. So what my article is suggesting is we need to look at what we're spending. And In as much as the Croke Park Agreement, and I do disagree with the Croke Park Agreement, but in as much as the Croke Park Agreement seeks to protect the pay and jobs of public sector workers, even if you agree with the Croke Park Agreement, how could you possibly agree when the state is bust with giving public sector workers pay rises as we go through this IMF bailout? The public sector get what are called increments, which are in effect pay rises, which are, depending on who you speak to, ostensibly about either performance or longevity in the job. But in effect, they're automatic. And the longer you're there, the more you'll get. They cost, let's say, 200 million euro every year. 200 million euro every year. And so now we come back to the choices that we have to make in the budget. Are we going to give 200 million euro worth of pay rises every year? Or are we going to hit a 59% income tax for people? Are we going to close down wards? Are we going to cut carers' allowance? Are we going to cut children's allowance? Are we going to cut disability allowance? These are the choices that are going to have to be made. And what I was suggesting in the article was that really we can't conscience pay rises in the public sector at this point in time. The private sector is overtaxed, and the people receiving the benefits of the services that we have been cut enough.
You're making your point very well, Keith, but I would look at one or two topics that you mentioned there. I mean, I think we had an article there during the week, if I'm correct, I think I am, that the juniors going into the public service, they're going in on 22 grand. They have increments that bring them up to 33,000 over a 16-year period. But to me, you know, we're talking here about the ordinary Joe soap. It's the bloody bigger money we should be talking about, and people get big handouts on retirement.
Yeah, but you see, that makes sense from an emotional point of view, but the problem is...
But it's
from
a practical sense,
no,
too.
But from the financial point of view, it doesn't make too much sense, because when you only go to the people who are on higher wages in the public sector, if you decided to cut everybody in the public sector to 100,000 euro, if you just picked this figure out of your head and just said, oh, well, everybody, that's my fairness figure, and I'm going to pick that figure, you actually don't save too much money. The problem is that if you're taking the 40 euro a month off somebody who's on 25,000 euro, it may seem mean, but those 40 euros all add up. And they all add up to 200 million euro a year. Mm-hmm. So, unfortunately, you can't say, well, we're going to go after the wealthiest in the public sector and we're going to take their money. And we're going to go after the wealthiest in society and we're going to take their money. And then everything will be magically
fixed.
It's
not taking their money.
But that's not the way it works.
It's not taking their money, Keith, with respect. It's not taking their money. There's a few things. And Dermot picked on a very good one as well. This idea that you were kind of purporting earlier on. There is not increments for life or for the period that you're in. We're in the civil service. It stops after... There are certain periods that you get increments for, and then
a 16-year period, and you've nothing beyond that.
That's right.
other than a promotion within the department,
that's right,
or recognised for something special you're doing. But that 16-year period where you get those increments is automatic, but once it comes to 16 years...
But we're talking about a period of time when we are under an IMF bailout. I'm not talking about 16 years from now. I'm talking about in a period of time we are here in being bailed out by the IMF, we can't afford to run our own country, and we're giving pay rises.
Sorry, Dermot. There's a few things on this. Firstly, these are negotiated. And when we talk about the revenue or whatever is that we're spending, the population has risen, and people are living longer. That's one of the reasons. We've also had a situation the last couple of years. Yeah,
what's that got to do with anything?
You were talking about the exchequer. There's more people getting. There's more people
we're
getting.
We're not cutting spending.
We're spending because we have to in a lot of cases, because we have more people out of work.
We've all had higher expectations.
That is the problem. We've all had a higher expectation and an entitlement.
Higher expectations about the quality, the level of healthcare we need, the level of education we need.
But we're cutting those, education, and we're giving the money instead into social welfare and bailouts. So we're not adding money to that. No, I'm talking about the redirection of the expenditure. We're spending the same amount of money.
Well, you are, but there's a few other things as well that you have to take in mind. That a lot of people working in the civil service now are actually getting family income support, especially people on the lower level. And if you have people on 22,000, and even if it comes up to the princely sum of 34 or 35 after 16 years, in a lot of cases, the people, the lower paid and the medium paid in this society, all of their money, They don't have an opportunity to save money. All of their money goes in to pay for the corner shops, to pay for, because they don't have discretionary spending. They need to spend the money that they get, and that money goes straight into the exchequer. That doesn't go into savings in a lot of cases. It happened with the minimum wage. When the minimum wage, which thankfully this government rescinded, when the minimum wage was brought down, it decreased people's money by 12%. That money was money that when they were getting the minimum wage, all of that money was going straight back into the economy because they were having to buy stuff in order to survive. Now, what this one princely 1 euro that went back onto it, all of that money goes straight back into the bottom line. And we should remember that as well. It's very easy to demonise the civil service. Now, they have a lot, and
I'm not trying to demonise anybody.
By the way,
what I'm saying is there are choices. No, I'm not. I'm saying there are choices that have to be made.
Your choices are all one way. Don't tax those on high money and have a belt at the people who are very low money.
We have 52% income tax on people on over 32,000. So what are you talking about? We already have probably the highest marginal rate in the OECD. So what are you talking about?
We also have a lot of indirect taxes. I'm agree with you on that. But what you're saying is, tax more the people, or take more money from the people who are on very little already.
But I'm talking about you miss what you never had? I'm talking about stopping pay rises. Pay rises. We're not talking about taking people's salary. I'm talking about pay rises.
Gentlemen, just for a minute, you're both making good points, but you're at loggerheads here on one thing.
Because we disagree.
Because you disagree.
Have you spotted
and
it?
It's great that you disagree, because it just teases it out a little further than we would otherwise tease it out. But the point is very valid that, you know, people on the up to 33,000, when you look at people and higher brackets, and they talked about the banks this week, where they're still getting increases, getting rises that, you know, are part of the
plan. Because they're worth it. Yeah.
Now, like to say they're worth it, but as he rightly said, we're in a crisis. And
you only object to pay rise in the private sector, is that it, Chair?
No, I don't. And by the way, a lot of people in the private sector are on the same money that they were on 3 or 4 years
ago. They're on far less.
Heidi.
I think we're running out of time. I'm just going to say one thing. I think rather than picking individuals within society, we need to look at creating more equality. So there's more. Everybody's paid more or less similar rates, that we don't have huge disparity between earnings.
That didn't work in the Eastern Europe, and it's not going to work here.
Hold on. And within the civil service itself, there's huge inequalities. People paid huge salaries, and then the bulk of the people working in the public service paid quite average wages. I don't think it's as simple as Keith is saying, but I agree with your overall argument, is that we don't have enough money for what we have to pay out, and that's the crux of the matter. And we need to reform a lot of our pay scales.
Just on what Tom was saying, can I remind, I don't think anybody feels that the TDs are paid too little, and that their wage is linked to the top civil servants as well. So if we want to reduce all those top salaries, we have to grasp the nettle, really. One point that Keith mentions. Now, I am in favour of raising taxes. I think our taxes are still quite low compared to maybe
52% is too low.
15, 20 years ago. Well, I do remember
were 60-odd%. Look what it did to the country. Destroyed any kind of ingenuity,
If you don't have the money, you don't have the money. But one thing you point out in your article...
So what, you take it off someone else?
But it's
all our money. We don't have the money.
This is not a socialist republic. It's not all our money.
How do you pay for services?
There's only one source of money, and that's the people.
Then you look at what services you want to provide, you look at the cost of providing those services, and you start to reduce the cost and reduce the kind of services that you're providing.
We're probably going to have to realise that we can't have the same standard of living that we've been enjoying for the last few years, that there's going to be drops, and it's going to continue for another 3 or 4 years.
Just because we can't afford it.
There was one point you made there, though, Keith, that was very poignant, I felt, and it's that Minister Brendan Howland is negotiating with the public sector unions. Now, this goes back to an argument from a long time ago where funding affects parties, and in the same way that Fianna Fáil couldn't be trusted to control, if you like, the developers, because that's where a lot of their funding was coming from. Perhaps the Labour Party are not the best people to be negotiating with the public sector unions, because that is where a lot of their funding comes from.
4%. It's almost laughable.
4%.
4%
of Labour's funding comes from the unions. 4%.
Folks. He's a former trade union official. He's a former trade union official.
I'm sorry, we have to cut it there.
4% of Labour's money comes from the trade union.
They're funded by
them. There's a canard.
They're funded by
them.
Listen,
if it's so little, don't accept it.
Folks,
yeah,
I'm sorry. We have to.
Fair enough.
Folks,
I'd agree with
fair enough.
We have to cut it there. I'm sorry to cut it out. I know yous are all still with a lot to say, but we'll have to do it another day. I have a couple of comments here from John, and it's not about public service versus private sectors. The system is fundamentally flawed, and I think that's true.
That's what we've been saying.
Yeah. And Frank Connors, I agree with Keith. It's
unsustainable.
Why should public service rules be different to private? And that's extremely true. Now, if you want to find out more about Peter Preston's campaign, just email Ray. So that's just a comment there from Peter Preston, who we heard from earlier in the programme. So, folks, I'm going to say a sincere thanks. Sorry we had more time, because there's a lot more to be teased out there, but we'll have to leave.